the intersection, the interplay between kavod habrios, which means human dignity and human sensitivity, and the halachic process. So we have many times in halacha where there is a dilemma, and we'll speak in a few minutes about exactly what a dilemma is all about and how one should deal with a halachic dilemma. But sometimes what presents itself is a dilemma between my own human dignity, my own human sensitivity, and what the halacha demands of me. And the question is, what am I supposed to do under those kinds of circumstances? So by way of introduction to the topic in general, let us just see a beautiful comment of Reb Chaim Shmulevitz. And Reb Chaim Shmulevitz has in his Sefer Sichas Musar, commenting on the pasuk in the first line in Sefer Devarim, Moshe Rabbeinu here gives his valedictory address. It's his last time to speak to the Jewish people. And here he is, Be'ever HaYarden. Why is he on Ever HaYarden? Because as we know, Moshe Rabbeinu was not allowed access into the land of Israel. So here says the pasuk as follows, Ela HaDvarim Asher Diber Moshe El Kol Yisrael Be'ever HaYarden. These are the words that Moshe Rabbeinu spoke on the other side of the Yarden, meaning in Chutz La'aretz. And he goes through a whole number of places, and he then says, Ve'lavan V'chatzeros V'dizahav. Now Rashi says, what is this ambiguous terminology? What is he referring to? He just makes mention of a number of places where they traveled. He obviously does not enumerate all of them, but he makes mention of a few. So why does he choose a few locations where they traveled as they were in the desert? Says Rashi, Shemanakan. Moshe Rabbeinu here makes mention of kol hamakomos, of all of the places, Sheikh Isan Behem Lefnei Hamakom, of all of the locations where the Jewish community angered, so to speak, God himself, where they disappointed him. V'hizkiran beremez. However, Moshe Rabbeinu makes sure to only mention them in passing. He does not want to mention these averos, these terrible mistakes, explicitly. Mipnei kevodan shel Yisrael. Because he's sensitive to the feelings of the Jewish people. What would happen if Moshe Rabbeinu would get up and speak openly about the terrible blunder, about the terrible mistakes that we had made? That would be a violation of our human dignity, and that wouldn't be respectful. And therefore Moshe Rabbeinu decides he's going to say it only beremez. He's going to hint to it. He's just going to mention the places where these terrible mistakes happen, but he's not going to speak about the mistakes themselves. So writes Reb Chaim Shmulevitz, let's just read a little bit together from the beginning of this paragraph. You can read the rest on your own. It's beautiful, as are all of the Sichas Musar of Reb Chaim Shmulevitz. But here he writes the following. Moshe Rabbeinu Yamim Svurim Lefnei Moso. This is Moshe Rabbeinu just a few days before his demise. Bevo Lehochiach Es Am Yisrael. This is his opportunity to give Tochacha. This is his opportunity to censure the Jewish people. Like an old grandfather before he passes away, sometimes has to have difficult conversations with some family members, and this is now Moshe Rabbeinu's job as well. And he has to talk to them about hachatayim, hayiduim, v'hamufursamim lakol. He has to speak to them about some major, very well-known mistakes. This was not a secret to anybody. And amongst those mistakes were, as we know, this week's parsha, the terrible story of the Chet HaEgel, and all the mefarshim try to explain how did it be, and how is it possible you can have a Jewish people that accept the Torah, and then Chet HaEgel, it came out of Kriyas Yamsuf. How can that be? How can it happen? So we have, number one, the mistake of the Egel. We have, number two, the mistake of Chet HaMeraglim. How can it be that they fell to such a low level, and we're told that the payment that they had to pay, the price for those terrible mistakes, was awful. Many of the members of the Dor HaMidbar were killed out. None of them were allowed to enter into the land of Israel. It was a terrible story. And Moshe Rabbeinu has to talk to the Jewish people about these horrific mistakes, which everyone is well aware of. Every single family, I would imagine, had family members who died along the way as a result of these mistakes. This was not a secret. And yet, skip down two lines, third word on the line, Afal Pikein. Even though Moshe Rabbeinu wanted to talk to them about these very major issues and terrible mistakes, Afal Pikein, Nizhar Shelo Lefaret Es Hachatayim Beferush Ela Beremes. Moshe Rabbeinu chooses not to speak about the Avera head on. All he does is makes mention to the place where these terrible mistakes happen. Why? Kidei Shelo Levaisham. In order not to embarrass or humiliate the Jewish people. Now writes Reb Chaim Shmulevitz, didn't Moshe Rabbeinu have an obligation? Hocheach tochiach hasam yisecha. This is my job. I am the parent here. I am the leader. This is my job to set them straight. Yes, it is your job. But there's a way in which your job needs to be done. it has to be done with sensitivity. So I mentioned yesterday when I spoke in Teaneck that a couple of weeks ago we had a young couple's meal here in the shul. And there was a four-year-old kid who was doing what four-year-old children normally do. He was crawling under the tables. I'm sure he was annoying a number of people. And his father came and started yelling at him in front of everyone. And I was so sad for this kid. So it's true, the father and mother have an obligation to educate their child how to behave. But there's a way in which we need to do that. There's a sensitivity that needs to be present when we educate our children, when we do our mitzvah of Hocheach Tochiach Es Amisecha, or whatever it might be. Moshe Rabbeinu teaches us there's a sensitivity that needs to be present when doing whatever it is that needs to be done. Writes Reb Chaim Shmulevitz, Ha'ein Zeh Melamdeinu, does this not teach us? Magedola Maisa Mailas Kavod Abrios V'Chiyuv HaZehiros Bazeh, doesn't this show us how critical, how much of a premium we put on this idea of Kavod Abrios, and how careful we all need to be when it comes to human sensitivity, when it comes to human thought and feeling? And this is something we all need to keep in mind. Reb Chaim Shmulevitz then goes further. We won't read it inside, but he develops his point to the next step, and he says, maybe one will argue that we only have to be extremely careful when we're dealing with the entire entity, which is the sacred entity of the Jewish people. So here Moshe Rabbeinu has to be careful because he's dealing with Klal Yisrael. How do you know, Reb Chaim Shmulevitz, that even when you're dealing with somebody who he refers to as Avi Havos Pachos Shebeprusim, how do you know even when you're dealing with, I guess we would say in our vernacular, the greatest lowlife, how do you know that you need to be sensitive to such a human being as well? How do you know that you need to be careful about how you interact with them as well? So Reb Chaim Shmulevitz proves that from the story of Bilam HaRasha. I think all of us would agree that Bilam HaRasha was one of the personalities who was in the all-star list of those who tried to destroy the Jewish people. And yet Moshe Rabbeinu, when he has this story with Bilam, the Torah tells us that Bilam has the strange interaction with his donkey, and in the end, what happened? The Torah sort of cuts off in the middle of a story. The donkey outsmarts Bilam, and then we don't hear anything else about this whole interaction. The story ends. So Rashi there picks up on the story and he says, well, what ended up happening to that donkey? It sounds like it was some supernatural entity, something really amazing. Where did it go afterward? And Rashi quotes the Medrash that HaKadosh Baruch Hu decided to kill the donkey. Why? What did the donkey do wrong? Why should it lose its life? It actually fulfilled its purpose very well and did its job as it was instructed to. So why did the donkey lose its life? Rashi explains, because we feel bad. Because what would happen if that donkey stayed alive? Anyone future in history who would pass by that donkey would say, that's the donkey that was able to outsmart Bilam. And that wouldn't be fair to the feelings of Bilam if that's the way people would speak about him. Don't you feel bad for him?
No.
Writes Reb Chaim Shmulevitz, what we're taught here in the Torah is, even when you're dealing with Bilam HaRasha, a human being who tried to destroy the Jewish people, there's a sensitivity that needs to be there as well. And there's a caring that we need to think about. And even though this could have resulted in the greatest Kiddush Hashem, writes Reb Chaim Shmulevitz, if it was in our times, we would take that donkey, we would honor the donkey at every dinner and throughout the country, and we would show the world, this is what happens when you try and start up with the Jewish people and you try to destroy them, even a donkey is better than you. And yet we don't do that. We forgo the Kiddush Hashem, and we ignore all of that, because there's a human sensitivity that needs to be present, and we need to be thoughtful and mindful of it whenever we deal with others. And therefore, writes Reb Chaim Shmulevitz, what you prove from this is that Kavod Abrios is not something that is limited to a sacred entity like the Jewish people, or somebody who is known to be a great human being. Kavod Abrios is something that applies even to someone who you believe is the greatest of lowlives, somebody who tried to even destroy your people. Kavod Abrios is something that we need to think about there as well. So with that brief introduction, let us now get involved in the story. And the story is, how is one to deal with a halachic dilemma when you have, on the one hand, human sensitivity that will be compromised, Kavod Abrios we refer to it as, where on the other hand, we are going to compromise the halachic standard that we're supposed to live by. And we'll speak about in greater detail what exactly that means and some examples of this. But just to give a second introduction to make us better understand the topic, let me just say the following. Just to define the terms, what does a halachic dilemma actually mean? What does a dilemma in any area of life mean? So let us just break it down. A dilemma is obviously when you have two options in front of you and you don't know what to do. Well, if one option was going to yield a positive result and one option would yield a negative result, that's not a dilemma. That's clear. Everybody knows you should choose the right choice. A dilemma is where I have two options in front of me and both of them perhaps will yield a negative response, a negative result, and the question is, I now have a dilemma, which one should I choose? Which one will bring about the least negative response from my reaction, from whatever it is that I choose to do? That is what we refer to as a halachic dilemma. When I have two things in front of me, both of them are going to mean that something negative is going to happen, and I don't know exactly what to do. And sometimes people mistakenly think that the greatest way to reduce or minimize the amount of negativity that will come about is sheva al taseh. Just be passive. Don't actively engage in doing anything wrong, and that is a mistake. You cannot just sit by and allow things just to play out the way they do. If you are actively able to get involved and minimize the amount of negative result that will come about, that is what you should do, even though it means you're actively engaged in something that seems to be wrong. But because you're mitigating the amount of negative result, therefore perhaps that is the right thing to do, to assert oneself and to actively involve themselves in what is wrong, instead of just being passive and letting things happen the way they do. This is clear from the Gemara. We won't go into the proof from the Gemara, but it's clear throughout the last 300 years, many Achronim have written the same kinds of ideas in many different contexts. And unfortunately, this is a story that just presents itself in many different ways, but it's the basic storyline that just presents itself over and over again. So I remember when I was in the White Shul, there was a man, an elderly gentleman who was a survivor of the Holocaust, who every Shabbos Mincha, the same exact thing happened, and after 3 years of me watching the same thing, he finally explained to me what it was that was going on. So the White Shul has a minhag. And I've never seen this anywhere else. I haven't been so many other places, but I've never seen it documented either. But the White Shul has a minhag that on Shabbos afternoon, when they take the Sefer Torah out of the Aron Kodesh to lane by Mincha, they first remove all of the gold and silver on the Sefer Torah before they take it out. What's the reason for that? Why would you take it off? So the reason is because the Gemara says that Moshe Rabbeinu, it is assumed that he died on Shabbos afternoon. And we want to highlight the fact that there's something lacking as a result of Moshe Rabbeinu not being here. The crown jewel of our Torah is not here. This is why Shabbos afternoon by Mincha we say Tzidkas HaTzedek. Every Shabbos afternoon for those who daven Mincha, we almost make it Tzidduk HaDin. We accept the judgment of HaKadosh Baruch Hu that he took Moshe Rabbeinu away from us. And we commemorate the fact that Moshe Rabbeinu is no longer here. So that's the way the White Shul does it. They take off the gold and the silver to show that the pride and glory of the Jewish people, on top of its Torah, is no longer here because Moshe Rabbeinu died on Shabbos afternoon. Okay. Every Shabbos afternoon, without fail, this man, when they would take the Sefer Torah out of the Yaron, would start crying. Every week. And I would stand there next to him and watch, and I never bothered to ask him because I didn't feel it was my business. And after 3 years, he came over to me and he said, you know, you're probably wondering why I start crying every Shabbos when we take the Sefer Torah out by Mincha. I said, actually, I have been wondering. So he says, let me explain. When I lived in Europe, he said, we realized that our community was going to be the next to be destroyed by the Nazis. And the night before that happened, the Rav of our town, I don't remember where he said he came from, he said the Rav of his town came to him and his younger brother and he asked them to spend the entire night going to the shul, taking all the gold and silver from the Sifrei Torah and melting it into the ground. Because he was concerned that if the Nazis are going to come and find the gold and silver, they're going to defile and desecrate the gold and silver and use it for a purpose that is certainly not a holy one. And therefore he said, the Rav told us that I would prefer that you spend the evening melting all of this into the ground instead of our enemies getting their hands on it and doing something worse. He told me that he obviously listened. Him and his brother spent the entire evening doing that. And he said that he hasn't slept one night since. He said, I saw many horrible things in the Holocaust, and there were many things that were troubling. But this thought has never come away from his mind, because he feels that he was involved in something that seems to be so disrespectful to what a Sefer Torah stands for. So it wasn't the time and place to get into a halachic discussion with him whether it was right or it was wrong, but the truth is Many Achronim have similar discussions. So the Shavus Yaakov has a discussion that is almost the same story, where he talks about a concern that an enemy would come in and take our Sifrei Torah themselves and destroy the Sifrei Torah and use them for purposes that were certainly not holy. And the Shavus Yaakov was one of the greatest Achronim in the last few hundred years. He writes that the preferred option would be that we as the Jewish community should preempt that, and we should take the Sifrei Torah and actually burn them. We should take the Sifrei Torah and actually burn them instead of allowing our enemies to do far worse. Once again, what you see from this is that when you're confronted with a difficult situation, the answer is not always sheva al tasa. The answer is not always just sit back idly and let things play out however they do, as painful as that is going to be. Sometimes we have to mitigate the amount of negative result, and we need to make sure that we actively engage. Yes, unfortunately, in some generations, they had to burn their own Sifrei Torah. Unfortunately, this man in the white shul had to spend the whole evening melting the gold and silver into the ground, and it was the right thing to do. It was the right thing to do, because it brought about less negative result than otherwise would have been had they let the enemy come and take all of these items and use it on their own. For those of us who are familiar with the halachic process over the last generation, it is quite clear that one of the pioneers of halacha as we understand it today was Reb Shlomo Zalman Auerbach. And he was a personality who was a tremendous Torah giant, but not only his genius in Torah, but also his ability to integrate science and medicine and halacha all together and to show the world this was something that was a novel idea, it was a novel approach of his. Until his time, there weren't many who understood how to integrate all of the science that was being exposed in the world and how that is supposed to fit with the halachic process. So Reb Shlomo Zalman was one of the greatest people of the last generation. But outside of his greatness and his Torah and his Psakim and his Tshuvas that he wrote, he was also known to be a tremendous gadol in his sensitivity and his caring and his thoughtfulness to other people. And you can say so many stories. We have someone who's a family member of Reb Shlomo Zalman. I'm sure you can validate all the stories that are being told. And in just so many different ways, he showed his tremendous sensitivity. So I recently read a story, and then they cross-referenced another book that had the same story. I would imagine if two books write the same story, it's probably true. So they say that Reb Shlomo Zalman Auerbach's wife passed away on a Shabbos afternoon, or late Shabbos afternoon. And he was leaving the hospital on Matzah Shabbos. Some family members came to take over and figure out what to do with the Chevra Kadisha. He was leaving the hospital. He decided, you know, I want a few minutes of quiet. I want to figure out what I'm going to say at a hesped. I want to figure out, you know, how I want all this to go. So he decided that it was Matzah Shabbos, and everybody's already taking the elevators down. He's going to take the staircase. This way, he doesn't want to bump into anybody. He doesn't want to talk to anyone. He's just going to walk home by himself from Shari Tzedek to Shari Chesed. And this way, he's just going to have some time to think. He walks out of his room, goes down the staircase a few doors down, and as he gets a few flights down, right there, one of his Talmidim from his yeshiva bumps into him in the stairwell. He was coming out from the maternity ward, and he says, Rebbe, I can't believe I'm bumping into you here. He says, why? He says, I'd like you to know, my wife just had a baby. So Reb Shlomo Zalman very patiently listens, and he wishes him a mazel tov, and he hugs him, and he kisses him, and he's talking to him, and he asks him, so how's she feeling? So he says, you know, it was a difficult labor, and she had some stitches, and it wasn't as easy as we expected. So Reb Shlomo Zalman asked, would you like if I came in to visit her? Would she appreciate a visit? So he said, you know, she's not feeling that well right now. She just had the baby, just walking out to get something to eat. Maybe right now is not the right time, but thank you so much. And they start talking, and he says, so when's the bris going to be, and where is it going to be? And he gets in a whole discussion with him about a half an hour. And after this is all over, Reb Shlomo Zalman wishes him well, and he goes down, and he continues out of the hospital. That night, this young man goes home, and he sees signs all over Yerushalayim that the wife of the Gadol Hador has just passed away, and the Levaya is going to be that evening. And he's beside himself. He understood that obviously he caught Reb Shlomo Zalman at a very bad time, and he was having this, you know, not important conversation at all. And he comes to the Shiva, and he's so ashamed, he's so embarrassed, he doesn't even know how he's going to face his Rebbe, what's he going to say? And he goes over to him, he says, you know, I really have to beg Mechila from you. And he says, why? He says, I don't know if you remember, but a few nights ago, I bumped into you in the staircase. I assume that that's when all this was going on with your family. I had no idea. And Reb Shlomo Zalman said to him, why does the fact that my wife passed away impact your baby that you just had? Are you not deserving of people wishing you mazel tov and wondering how your wife is doing? Why should it make a difference that my wife just passed away? That was Reb Shlomo Zalman Auerbach. Many, many stories that they write about him like that. And anyone who had a personal interaction with him knew that that was the way he thought. And that was the sensitive person that he was. I told a story yesterday that Rabbi Yisrael Meir Lau has a son by the name of Rabbi Tzviki Lau. He's much older than I am, but he used to drive me home every week from a shir in Bayit Vegan back to the Mir Yeshiva. And I got to know him quite well. So one night when we were driving home after the shir, so there was a... It happened to be the yahrzeit of Reb Shlomo Zalman Auerbach. So I said to him, you know, maybe you can tell me something. I'm sure your father had many interactions with him. So maybe you can tell me something interesting. So he did. And he told me that his father, when he was involved in politics in his younger years, so there was a time when there was a Chavar HaKnesset who was fighting vehemently that they should close off all the streets in Yerushalayim on Shabbos. Too many religious Jews around. Why do we have cars going? It takes away from the ambiance of Shabbos. It's not right. And he was negotiating, and the mayor of Yerushalayim had no interest in listening to this request. He didn't want the streets to be closed, but at some point he felt that he had to give in because of political reasons, and he had to go ahead and draw up a map to close off the streets in Yerushalayim as the Chavar HaKnesset had asked. So he calls up the Chavar HaKnesset one day, and he says, you know, I finally drew up a map, and I'd like you to come to my office today. I'd like you to sign off on the map, because now we have the ability to go ahead with the plans. So the Chavar HaKnesset comes, and he looks at it, and he was disappointed, because he had expected far more streets to be closed, but he didn't want to sound like a person who's not willing to negotiate, so he blamed it on Reb Shlomo Zalman Auerbach, and he said, I'm never allowed to sign anything without going to the God of Reb Shlomo Zalman Auerbach to okay it, and I'm sure he's not going to be okay with this, so let me just take the map to his house, and I'll be back a little later. So he takes the map, he goes to Reb Shlomo Zalman Auerbach's home, and he shows it to him, and he asks him, so what do you think? And Reb Shlomo Zalman says, how can you sign off on such a thing? So he says, what do you mean? So Reb Shlomo Zalman says, where's your sensitivity? How many unaffiliated Jews live in Yerushalayim? A few thousand. Do you understand that by you closing off these major intersections, you're going to cause them to do more Chilul Shabbos as a result of what you're doing? Because now they're going to have to take detours and stay in the cars longer because all the streets that they normally drive on are closed. Is that something that you thought about? Is that something that you're willing to take responsibility for? And Reb Shlomo Zalman said, we absolutely cannot sign off on this map because it's just not being thoughtful. It's not being sensitive to all the unaffiliated Jews who live in our backyard, who live together with us. That was Reb Shlomo Zalman Auerbach. So the story goes, he writes this story in a tshuva in Chelek Aleph in the Mincha Shlomo. And the story that he writes is that there was a family who dedicated a building to his yeshiva in Bayit Vegan. And this family happened to be a non-religious family from London. And they came for the dedication ceremony, and it was a boiling hot day in Yerushalayim. After the ceremony was over, Reb Shlomo Zalman invited them into the building, and he asked them to come join him for something to eat and something to drink. And all of his Talmidim were in a tizzy. How did he do such a thing? So he was surprised why they were surprised. And they said to him, well, don't you know that the Ramah writes pretty clearly that one is not allowed to offer food to an irreligious Jew who they know is not going to recite a bracha before eating or drinking that food or drink? So what right did you have to invite them upstairs and give them something to eat or drink when you knew from the outset that they were not going to make a bracha? And Reb Shlomo Zalman writes his response. And he says the following mashal. He says, imagine you have somebody who comes into the doctor's office, he has a terrible infection in his leg. And the doctor checks it out, he says, you know, you have a gangrenous leg, I don't know what to do, we have no option but to amputate your leg. So Reb Shlomo Zalman Auerbach said, if you were looking from the outsider perspective, watching what's going on here, how would you classify such a doctor? How would you categorize him? Would you say he's a mazik? Would you say he's just destroyed this person's life because he amputated his leg, he crippled him? Or would you understand that, no, he's a matzil? He just saved the man's life, because had we not amputated the leg, the infection would have spread to the entire body and he would have died. So how would you look at that? Asked Reb Shlomo Zalman. It's clear, he says, to anybody that's thinking rationally, it's clear that that doctor did what he was supposed to do and did the right thing. You saved somebody's life. Well, writes Reb Shlomo Zalman Auerbach, whenever you have a halachic dilemma, you have to weigh out the two options and you have to figure out which one of these two options is going to bring about the least negative result? Writes from Shlomo Zalman Auerbach. Let's try to play out the scenario here. We have a family from London who came to dedicate a building to a yeshiva. It's their first interaction with religious Jews. And after the ceremony is over, they're boiling hot. So what would happen if I invite them upstairs to have something to drink and they don't make a bracha? So they violate a nisa d'rabbanan. Mid-rabbanan, you're supposed to make a bracha on the food that you eat, on the drinks that you drink. So they would have violated an isa d'rabbanan. What would happen if I would not have invited them upstairs? Writes of Shlomo Zalman, I have no doubt that they would hate religious Jews forever. What kind of people are these? They can't even offer me a cup of coffee, they can't offer me a drink, nothing? They're not willing to be at least as decent as that after all that we've done and they kept us out here in the sun? Nothing? That would be a Torah prohibition of lo sisna es achicha bilavavecha. So Rabbi Shlomo Zalman writes, when we weigh the two options and we try to figure out which one is the preferred one, obviously we need to say that we have to choose one. But you have to figure out which one is going to bring about the least negative result. Once again, it's an example of where you find that the answer is not always sheva al ta'aseh. The answer is not always just sit back and be passive and allow things to fall however they do. Sometimes we need to actively engage ourselves in order to save the situation from ending up being far worse. And that's where Shlomo Zalman Auerbach writes that this is something that he grappled with and it's something that he thought strongly about. Again, you might have to be your Shlomo Zalman Auerbach to know all of the tentacles of an issue that presents itself, and you have to know all of the implications of what it is that presents itself in front of you. However, one has to make a determination whether or not the choice that I'm making will make me into a mazik, or it will make me into a matzil. Am I doing the right thing by what it is that I'm engaged in, or am I being about a more negative result as a result of what it is that I choose to do? So I remember about 15 years ago when the Gaza disengagement took place, and that was a terrible story, a terrible time in Jewish history, and 2 days before the disengagement, they had invited my father to come up to the communities there to come and give shiurim to the many yeshivas that were there in the shuls and to try to give chizuk. Now, I don't know how exactly you give chizuk. What are you supposed to say when people's lives are about to be destroyed? So we went, and a few family members came along as well. And I remember very clearly, one of the vivid memories that I have of that whole story was after we finished in one of the yeshivas, one of the rabbeim in the yeshiva came over to my father and he said the following. He said, I've spent my entire life building this yeshiva. I've had hundreds of students that have come through its walls and have grown to become wonderful people, contributing human beings to society. This is my whole life. And he said, I'm afraid in 2 days from now, when the Arabs are going to come and take over our community, that they're going to use my building for a mosque. So he asked my father, do I have a right to firebomb my own yeshiva on the way out? Do I have a right to destroy the building so that it won't be used for something that is a less than holy, a less than sacred purpose? Again, these kinds of questions present themselves, unfortunately, in every generation, in many different ways. But what you see from all of this is that one needs to make a very careful determination as to what is the right choice in all of these kinds of scenarios. What choice should I be making? What will bring about the least negative result? And how can I save the situation from being worse than it can possibly be? Now, with that in mind, let us get into the discussion about Kavod HaBrios dilemmas.
What was his answer?
The answer is not so relevant. The question, I think, is more important. And again, like I said, I think these kinds of questions were the same kinds of questions that present themselves in every generation, just in a very different formulation. It keeps happening over and over again, but it's a real question.
Aren't you supposed to have hope till the very end that Hashem could perform a miracle and save the yeshiva?
Not when you're being thrown out. This was the end. And I think, actually, I do remember it was a terrible mistake. Not that I blame anybody, but most of the homes that we went to visit there did not believe at all that anything was going to happen. They absolutely didn't. They didn't pack anything. They just left everything where it was. So who loses out as a result of that? And it was a mistake that there were great rabbanim. My father told me at the time he was very upset. There were great rabbanim who got up and said, don't leave, don't pack anything up, it's never going to happen. Who are you to say it's never going to happen? Are you a Navi? Nistarim darkei Hashem. You don't understand why things happen. But we have to live life al pi derech hateva. And we have to live life based on the rules and principles. Yes, do we hope for miracles? Maybe. But we need to be realistic people. If somebody has cancer, Rachmana Litzlan, you can't just say, well, I believe that Hashem can do anything and therefore I'm not going to go for treatment. That would be a silly choice to make. That would actually be something that would not be allowed for a choice of someone to make. So we have many examples of this, but at the same time we need to very carefully make sure that we do our part as human beings and what the Ribono Shel Olam expects us to be doing at that time. So let us look at the one source that the Gemara has about this dilemma of Kavod HaBrios. And he turned the page, and the Gemara has a very strange story. Just keep in mind, when the Gemara is talking here about clothing, it's not like we have today where we have a coat and then a jacket and then something underneath that. No. Back in the times of the Gemara, they had one article of clothing. They had one robe, and that's all that covered them. Nothing underneath, nothing on top. So the Gemara gives the following story. I bought a new article of clothing, and now I happen to be walking in the street, right in the middle of town. I'm on Central Avenue, and Hamotzi Kilayim Bebigdo. All of a sudden, I see the tag sticking out from my jacket, and I see that it says on it that there's wool and linen woven into this jacket. And I have a problem. What do I do? As we know, this is a Torah prohibition. You're not allowed to have something that has wool and linen woven in together. But what am I supposed to do? What's the alternative? I'm on the middle of a major street, and if I take off my clothing, that's a terrible humiliation. That's horribly embarrassing for a person. So what should I do? So the Gemara asks this question, and the Gemara says, the answer is, we are expected to have the strength to say, Poshto afila b'shuk. We are expected to be strong enough to say, you know what? What God wants of me right now is to humiliate myself. And I have to be willing to take my clothing off in the middle of the street when it's going to be horribly embarrassing, says the Gemara, that's what I'm expected to do. My taima, why? Because ein chachma ve'ein tvuna ve'ein etzel le'neged Hashem. If that's what God said to do, that's what a person has to be willing to do. That's what the Gemara says. However, the Gemara then says, when we're talking about an Isser d'Rabbanan, when we're talking about something that is not a biblical prohibition, but rather only rabbinic in its nature, then we say that Kavod HaBrios is the determining factor when we come to situations like that. And you have a right to completely overlook the Isser d'Rabbanan, don't pay attention to it at all, and focus only on the human sensitivity that is involved in this question. And therefore the Gemara says, take for example, a person is wearing an article of clothing, and it happens to have shatnez midrabanan. However you figure out how that can be, we would say keep the clothing on, don't wear it again next time, but keep the clothing on, and do not embarrass yourself, do not humiliate yourself, because all we're dealing with is an issur d'rabanan. So you'll say, what are the examples of this? There are so many. Just to give one practical example, the Gemara talks about a situation where in the times of Chazal, they did not have tissues and they did not have toilet paper like we have today, and they used to clean themselves off when they got dirty, they used to use rocks. How that works, I have no idea, but that's what they used to do. So the Gemara says, obviously, rocks are muktzah on Shabbos. You're not allowed to handle rocks on Shabbos unless you've designated them for a useful purpose. So for example, if I designate a rock in the front of my house in order to hold the door open, that is something that has a purpose on Shabbos, and that is no longer muktzah. If I designate a rock to be a paperweight on Shabbos, that is no longer muktzah because I have set it aside for a very important purpose. Like I always say, Chayiv Adam Lomar B'Loshon Rabbah, you have to say things exactly how they were taught to you. So whenever my father teaches this halacha to us in Shir, he always says, and if you're from those communities where they throw stones at cars on Shabbos, and you've set the stones aside before Shabbos for this very important purpose, then obviously those stones are not muktzah on Shabbos either. Now, is it the right thing to do? You might be violating other Isurim. But as far as muktzah is concerned, it would not be a prohibition of muktzah because you have designated the rocks from before Shabbos. Now what happens if I forgot to set rocks aside in order to clean myself on Shabbos, and now it turns out that I need them to clean myself? So what should I do? What would you tell a person? Don't relieve yourself the entire Shabbos because you forgot to set rocks aside? Does that make sense? Is that reasonable? Absolutely not. And therefore, the Gemara assumes that since the whole prohibition of using rocks on Shabbos that were not set aside is only an Isser d'Rabbanan of Muktzah, therefore we assume you can overlook the violation, the prohibition of Muktzah, and you can engage in whatever needs to be done because otherwise there will be a terrible violation of Kavod HaBrios. That's clear. Now you'll say it's totally irrelevant to us today because we don't use rocks anymore. Well, writes the Shemir Shabbos Gelchasa, it's extremely relevant. Just bring it down, extract from there to our scenario. What happens, I'm sure it doesn't happen in any of your homes, but one of my jobs before Shabbos is to make sure all of the bathrooms have tissues in them. And once in a while, every so often, I must admit, I make a mistake, and I don't remember to do the one job that I have. And yet, now you're faced with a situation, what am I supposed to do? So does anyone else ever had such a scenario?
Or if you're out somewhere and you have to go to the bathroom and it's Shabbos.
Yeah.
And you're going to a public toilet.
Correct. So the Shmirah Shabbos Kachasa writes, what is one expected to do in a scenario like that, should it ever happen? And he says, certainly something you could do, you might be able to do even more than this, but certainly something that's not even questionable is, you can ask a non-Jew to cut the toilet paper for you and leave a whole stack of toilet paper in the bathroom. Why? Because that's only a prohibition of Amira Lenachri, which is an Issur D'Rabbanan. And if we don't ask the non-Jew to do this for us, then we will violate someone's Kavod Abrios. If you tell people you have to hold back the entire Shabbos because we don't have cut toilet paper, I mean, that's insane. Or to tell someone you're going to have to go down the block every time you need to use the facility, it doesn't make sense. We're not used to that today. And therefore, writes the Shmira Shabbos Kilchasa, that would be something that would certainly be permissible. So let me just share a story that happened a number of years ago. I used to learn every day with my father, most of the day. And I remember it was a Sunday morning, and a few people came to talk to him about this question. And I was so enamored by the question, it was just so interesting to me, that I had called Rav Asher Weiss right away, and I asked him what he thought about it as well. Often I used to do that and see both of their perspectives, which are often very different from each other, but always very interesting. So I shared the story with him, and he ended up writing a tshuva about the story as well. But he's not the only one that wrote. Many people wrote about this story. So the story that happened was that there was a couple that got married on a Thursday evening in Lakewood, and Friday night was the Shabbos Shever Brachos. Now what happened by the wedding was, what is the one job that a chassan has when he comes to his wedding? One job.
Bring the ring.
That's all we ask of you. The girl has to keep a million and one things in mind. The guy has it easy. But this chassan understood that he was a careless person and he wasn't so responsible and he was not so attentive, and therefore he decided, I don't want to take the risk of forgetting the ring, the one job that I have. So he asked his older sister to please make sure that her job is to take care of the ring. And when I walk down the aisle and I'm standing under the chuppah, I want you to walk next to me and just slip it into my pocket. This way it's not my problem. Fine, that's what they did, very smooth, nobody even noticed, and she gives him the ring, they get married, everything's fine. It comes Friday night of the Shever Brachos, and the sister went to go wash her hands for the meal. And as we know, the Rama says the practice is when you wash your hands for Hamotzi, you're supposed to remove all of your rings before doing so. So she takes her rings off, and she realizes that the ring that she gave her brother was really her own wedding band, and she was still wearing his. Now, what does that mean? Means they didn't get married. He gave her a ring that didn't belong to him. So every so often you have a situation where this happens at a wedding, where the chassan forgot the ring. So somebody has to stand up and say, I'm willing to give my ring, and I give it b'lev shalem. I really want him to own it for now so that he can marry his wife. Okay, but that's not at all what they had in mind here. She did not want to give her own ring. She wanted to give his ring. She just made a mistake. Now, retroactively, you'll say, obviously, if she knew how terrible this would turn out, she would have given everything. But it doesn't work that way. At the time that he had the ring, it didn't belong to him, because it wasn't his. So what is one supposed to do? Here they are Friday night. They have 100 guests who are all assembled for the Shever Brachos, and it turns out this couple's not even married. So now you're going to have the chassan and kala have to sleep in two separate apartments in two separate homes, and you have to call off the entire Shever Brachos, and you have to go explain to everybody why it's called off. Must be that this runs in the family, this, you know, irresponsible gene runs in the family a little, and now you're going to have to embarrass the sister to tell everybody, by the way, she made a mistake, she gave the wrong one. It's terrible, so what are you supposed to do? So I feel horrible for the rabbi in Lakewood, because I'm sure he's an amazing rabbi, and I'm sure he's a great Talmud Chacham, but this kind of question doesn't come up that often. Now, the good news is that the next time this happens, so many people wrote about this issue, should it ever happen again, now everybody knows what to do. But the first time it happened, how should he know how to respond? So they go and they run to the rabbi's house and they ask him what to do. And he says, look, what should we do now? They're not married. So just call off the Shever Brachos. You paid for the caterer, you may as well all enjoy, but the chassan and kala have to sleep separately. And you got to explain to everybody why there's no Shever Brachos. Okay. It's very easy to be a Monday morning quarterback or a Sunday morning quarterback, but here, Sunday morning, everyone was talking. Did he do the right thing, the wrong thing? He should have done, he shouldn't have done. Well, here's what happened. What's the problem? Good? Nachon? Lo nachon. Because when you did that, you did not have in mind for Kiddushin. right? So you never got off the ground. It's a good question, but it's not correct, because you assume when you were going home that night, you assumed that that was the Nisuin, which was stage two. But if you don't have step one, you can't get to step two. Right? So you never got off the ground. So that's why they had a dilemma here. So what my father had said on the spot when they came to talk to him, and what I found fascinating was that Rav Asher Weiss said the exact same thing. The moment he was asked this question, he said the same thing. And I think there's obviously a truth to it. When both of them felt exactly the same Ahalach HaMachshava, when they just initially heard about the question, it shows how great Talmidei Chacham they are that they knew this at the tip of their fingers. But at the same time, it also shows that it's probably the right answer. So what they both suggested is the following. What is the reason why the couple couldn't just get married again on Friday night? Why can't we just give a ring and have a ceremony here and then solve all the problems? What's the issue with that? So the Gemara Maseches Beitza writes, why are we not allowed to do business on Shabbos? If I own a store, why can't I have people coming and buying and selling on Shabbos? What's the problem? So the Gemara says the issue is Gzeira Shema Yichtov. We're afraid that if you're going to run your business on Shabbos, maybe you're going to come ultimately to write something down. Why? Because you're going to write down the inventory, you're going to write a receipt, you're going to write how much money someone owes you, you're going to write down whatever it might be. And that is a Malacha D'Araisa. So because we're concerned it's going to lead to that, therefore we don't allow you to keep your business open on Shabbos either. The Gemara then extends from there and says, the same way you're not allowed to do business on Shabbos because of Mekach U'Memkar, which is going to lead to writing, so too you're not allowed to get married on Shabbos because it's Domeh L'Mekach U'Memkar, because it looks like a business transaction, even though we shouldn't speak about marriage that way. But there are things that are exchanged back and forth, and it does look like a little bit of a Mekach U'Memkar, and therefore the Gemara says, Midirabbanan, you're not allowed to get married on Shabbos because it's an extension of this law of not doing business, which is because of we're concerned that you're going to come to write on Shabbos. Clear? So the story goes as follows. The Rama, in the 1500s in Krakow, writes the story that happened in his community. There was a Yesoma in his neighborhood who unfortunately did not have parents who could pay for her to get married. And back in those days in the 1500s, if a girl didn't have money to put up for a marriage, there was no way she would ever get married. Just practically, how could they get married? They need some money to support themselves. So the community said, what a tragedy it would be if this girl would remain single for the rest of her life just because she doesn't have parents. We take it upon ourselves to raise the money in order that this woman should have the opportunity to get married. And that's what they did. So they scheduled a wedding for her, whoever the boy was, they scheduled a wedding for her on a Friday afternoon. Why? Very often they used to make weddings on Friday afternoon in order that they should save money. Because you have to make a wedding meal and you have to make a Friday night meal. So you may as well kill two birds with one stone. So they used to get married Friday afternoon, go right away into Kabbalah Shabbos, and then right after Shabbos started, they would sit down and have the meal, which also served as the meal for the wedding. Very nice, so that was the plan. And they had set the date for the wedding, and the community promised that they would put up the money. Chassan shows up on the date when they were supposed to get married, and the Kala shows up and says, unfortunately, we haven't yet come up with the money. Chassan says, look, I love you very much, but no money, no wedding. What do you want? What are we going to do? So he calls off the wedding. They go into Kabbalah Shabbos. Everyone's very upset. But what can they do? They don't have the money that they promised to bring. So they go into Kabbalah Shabbos, and right after they are Mekabel Shabbos and Shabbos actually sets in, the Gabbai Tzedakah runs into the shul and he says, I'd like everyone to know that we've come up with the pledges for the money in order to get this girl married. But now it's too late. It's already Shabbos. So they asked the Rama, what should we do? The Rama said, how dare we as a community wait until Matzah Shabbos for this girl to get married? Do you not understand how embarrassing and humiliating it already has been for her that she's a Yesoma and has to rely on the community to support her? It's embarrassing enough. Now you're going to tell her, wait another day, because we didn't have enough money at the time that we promised we would have it? Said the Rama, I will be Masada Kedushin here in the shul on Friday night on Shabbos and let everybody learn that this is the way we're supposed to act. Why? Because when you have a conflict here of Kavod HaBrios in its greatest form versus an Issur D'Rabbanan of getting married on Shabbos, he said, you completely overlook the Issur D'Rabbanan and you focus only on the Kavod HaBrios factor. That is what they did in Krakow. That is the psak of the Rama, and that's what my father suggested should have been done here as well. Now you had to have known this Tshuvas HaRama, which most people probably do not know. But that's what my father suggested should have been done here. Yes, Midrabanan, you're not allowed to get married on Shabbos. It's true. But can you imagine the amount of embarrassment that resulted because of this story? Can you imagine how humiliated the sister was on the Chasen and Kala, how embarrassed they were, and the whole family has to tell everybody why it is that this didn't work out? They could have had a private ceremony on Friday night. Nobody had to know. Go to the rabbi's house, have two eidim there, and let the couple get married there on a Shabbos. So again, here is another one of those examples where we follow the principle that the Gemara says of when you have a conflict between Kavod HaBrios and the Halacha, if it's only an Issur D'Rabbanan, we would overlook the Issur D'Rabbanan, and we would focus solely on the Kavod HaBrios issue. Let's just change the Gemara's case very slightly and see if anything will change in the Halacha then. The case that the Gemara told us was, Hamotzi Kilayim Bebigdo, I find shatnez in my own clothing. And I notice the tag. So says the Gemara, I have to be willing to take it off in the middle of the street, as embarrassing as that is, because otherwise I'm going to violate an Issur D'Oraisa. And that is unacceptable. Now let's change the case. The Rishonim change the case very slightly, and they say, what happens if I am totally oblivious? I don't know anything about clothing, and I'm walking in the street, I happen to be wearing an article of clothing that is shatnez, and there's someone behind me who owns the clothing store, who notices that I'm wearing something that is problematic. Do they have an obligation when I am completely oblivious to the fact that I'm doing anything wrong? Do they have an obligation to point it out to me where it's going to humiliate me? Or would you say perhaps the story changes there? Where I am completely unaware of the fact that I'm violating something, maybe they should just wait till I get home, give me a call that night and say, by the way, tomorrow you shouldn't wear that because it's a problematic garment, because there's shatnez in it. This was a major machlokas between the Rush and the Rambam, two of the Gedolei HaRishonim. Now, the Rambam passed away 50 years before the Rush was born, but still, they had a disagreement about how one is supposed to go about this kind of scenario. What should I do when I see somebody else doing something wrong and they are completely oblivious to what it is that they are doing wrong? So the Trumas HaDeshen, one of the great Rishonim in the 1300s, the early Achronim, I should say, 1300s, 1400s, he writes the following scenario. In his time, nobody slept with pajamas. All they had was a blanket, a sheet that used to cover them over, and that was it. So he says, the story happened that there was a dead body in the building, and everybody was sleeping, and we realized that there's a Kohen in this building. But the Kohen is sleeping without any clothing on. But he has to leave the building. So if we just quickly wake him up and tell him to jump out the window because there's a fire, he's going to be embarrassed because he's not wearing anything. That's option one. Option two is, go carefully, wake him up and say, by the way, somebody needs to talk to you outside. Maybe you can get dressed and come out. We have something to discuss with you outside. What should a person do in that kind of scenario? Writes the Trumas HaDeshen, that plays into this case. How should we behave when we know that it's going to totally humiliate him, and right now he is oblivious to the fact that he's doing anything wrong? He was sleeping. He doesn't know there's a dead body in the building. Why would he think that? So again, we have this kind of case where we have this uncertainty as to what one should do when you have Kavod HaBrios and the person is going to otherwise violate an Issur D'Oraisa, but they are oblivious to the fact that they're violating an Issur D'Oraisa. So Rabbi Avadia Yosef has many, many tshuvas where he discusses the Baal Tshuva revolution. Now it's an amazing phenomenon that we live in the Baal Tshuva revolution today, but there are many challenging questions that come along with that reality. So Rabbi Avadia has many different scenarios that played out. But Rabbi Avadia talks about one case that I always found fascinating. And he says there was a woman who was unaffiliated, who went to a secular university, who had a boyfriend, ended up becoming pregnant, but she was 18 years old and she didn't want to have this child, so she had a late-term abortion. Later on, she became a Balas Tshuva. She totally forgot about her past, had nothing to do with it at all. Now she's in her 30s. And she gets married to a nice young man, and they're living a beautiful lifestyle, and she decides that she does not want to share with him anything about her previous life. Whether that's the right decision or the wrong one, I don't know, talk to a therapist, but that's the decision that she made. Here they are, they have a baby, and it's a baby boy. So they make a bris, and now the husband starts arranging for a pidyon haben. The problem is, she knows that she's not supposed to have a pidyon haben for her son because this is not the first child that she had a pregnancy with. She had an abortion many years earlier. The problem is, if she's going to share that information with her husband, can you imagine how embarrassing that would be? Can you imagine how terribly humiliating that would be if she's going to now have to uncover all of the stories from her previous life and how much that's going to affect the overall shalom bayis of the family? A terrible thing to do. And therefore the question was, how should she react now? What should she do? So they went to Rabbi Avadia to ask him, not they, she went to Rabbi Avadia to ask him the question. And he writes in a lengthy tshuva that he feels the appropriate thing to do in this case is just to keep quiet. What's the worst case scenario? What's going to happen? The husband's going to make a bracha levatala. Rabbi Avadia writes, it's not clear whether a bracha levatala is an issa d'oraisa or an issa d'rabbana in the first place. But even if not, even if it's an issa d'oraisa, your husband is completely oblivious to the fact that he's doing anything wrong. He doesn't know. Why would he dream that this is not your first pregnancy? Why would he think that? And therefore he writes that under these circumstances, in this situation where you're concerned that there's going to be such a terrible violation of Kavod HaBrios if you disclose this information, Rabbi Avadia writes he thinks you have every right to remain silent and not to share the embarrassing piece of information with your husband. Once again, is it the right thing to do in terms of the couple Shalom Bayis? I don't know. But strictly halacha lemaisa, would we say that someone has a right to remain silent and not disclose that information? Perhaps yes. So a number of years ago, there was a story, and with this we'll close. There was a story of a couple who came from Chassidish homes, and their parents had arranged, they were not at all interested in continuing in that way of life, in the Chassidish way of life, but they got engaged, they were both religious, and the parents had arranged for the wedding to be either a year or 6 months from that time, a very long time after the engagement. And the couple came and asked the Shaila. They said, look, we know ourselves. We know that we're going to be living together for the next year anyway. We're not going to abstain. So what would you suggest that we do? Should we have a small private wedding ceremony now? This way we can save ourselves from violating an Aveira over the next year. And this way we'll be legitimately married. And the problem with doing that is, in a year from now when we actually are supposed to get married, there's going to be a fake wedding. There's going to be brachas being made under the chuppah, and every night of shever brachas, hundreds of bracha levatela. What should we do? Do we have a right to choose that option, or perhaps not? This was a real question. And I give credit to both sides. I give tremendous credit to the couple for the courage to even come forth and ask such a question. To be honest enough with oneself to know your shortcomings and to know the reality of your life, to even think of such a question. And I give tremendous credit to the rabbi who was actually asked. It shows how sensitive a person he is that a couple is not even afraid to ask him such a question. I think it says a lot about both sides. And part of the answer here was, once again, is it the right thing to your family to do such a thing and assume that they'll never find out? That's arguable, and that's a decision that the couple themselves have to make. But in terms of the strict letter of the law, would we allow a couple to do such a thing? There was a strong argument made that maybe yes. Number one, like we said, all we're dealing with is a bracha levatela, and don't think that means we should make light of a bracha levatela. Bracha levatela is something serious, but at the same time, the people who are making the brachas under the chuppah are completely oblivious to the fact that they're doing anything wrong. If I'm called up under a chuppah to make a bracha, if I attend the sheva brachas, why would I think that this couple has already been married for a year? I mean, when has that ever happened before? And in that case, where there's such a terrible violation here of the alternative, if they're going to live together, perhaps we should say that this is the preferred option. Once again, when one has a halachic dilemma, not always is the answer so simple. You have to weigh the possibilities and figure out, how can I possibly mitigate the situation to bring about the least negative result that can possibly come from the scenario that I'm confronted with? It's not always an easy answer. And one has to be tremendously learned and educated to know how to weigh out all of these factors together. But at the same time, certainly when we have a Kavod HaBrios issue that we're confronted with, very often the halacha will say that the right way to go is to make sure that we are sensitive and we are sure that we do whatever we can to think about the sensitivity of the human being who's asking the question and what will result in this question if we don't choose the Kavod HaBrios option, and we allow them to humiliate themselves. How humiliating will that be? And is it something that we're willing to take on ourselves by giving the psak that we do? It's something that we certainly need to keep in mind. And it's something that does need to go into the equation, which is, I think, an important concept in general to keep in mind, not just when we talk about these kinds of dilemmas, but kavod habriyos, like we started with from Reb Chaim Shmulevitz. It's an incredibly important value that the Torah puts a premium on, and the Torah does emphasize very heavily, not only from the way Moshe Rabbeinu addresses the Jewish people at the end of his life, but as we mentioned, from the way Bilam HaRasha is treated as well. You can be dealing with somebody the likes of Bilam HaRasha who tried to destroy your people, and yet you still have a responsibility to think carefully about how you treat that individual, about how sensitive you are to their feelings, and how thoughtful you're being to the psyche of that human being, and how you respond and how you react to whatever it is that they may have done.